This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers' Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This episode of our podcast contains explicit language.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
And I'm Vincent Cunningham. I'm a staff writer at the New Yorker.
In 2 weeks, one of the most unusual rap albums I've heard about in years comes out. About 40 different rappers and then another 30 singers, poets, and producers recorded the album together in the home of a former member of the KKK in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The album is a concept album about a long-forgotten piece of American history from 100 years ago that we all need to know more about. One of the artists and sort of the linchpin of the project is a rapper named Steph Simon. I heard about him from Taylor Hoskin, a journalist who covers music and culture. Steph Simon has been on a mission to convince the nation that we should all be paying more attention to the rap scene in Tulsa. So, Taylor, what's Steph like?
So, Steph is 33.
Is it good vocal? Is the vocal good?
He wears these wide-brimmed hats and these, like, suede jackets with all this fringe going on.
Okay.
He wears a lot of, like, crystals.
That's what this city is. We some stones, rocking, astrology people. We some energy freaks. You know what I'm saying?
I can see the smoke in the earth. I can see the fire burning. I can see the kids crying because their mom and daddy.
So he started getting into rap just casually in high school with his friends in the early 2000s.
My friends had a studio. Mm-hmm. And I would leave football practice to record with them, and I would just record them. I was trying to be like a manager.
So they're having a lot of fun recording together, just, you know, silly, carefree young days. And then his mom dies unexpectedly.
I'm a mama's boy. I didn't know how to grocery shop. I didn't know how to wash clothes. I didn't know how to pay bills. My car was in her name. I always knew if I got in a bind, I could call my mom's. And that was pretty much me. When my mom passed at 20, I used to like lock myself in these away from everybody else, away from the world places, basements and garages, and I would just hide out from every secluded area that I could find in the city, and I'd just sit there and write, just to keep my mind off of it.
So it sounds like it turns from fun to a kind of serious art right at that time.
Yeah, totally. But unfortunately, trying to be a rapper while staying in Tulsa was just unheard of. It was kind of conventional wisdom that you had to leave and go be where the industry is.
It was like, how the fuck am I supposed to make it in rap in Oklahoma? And people from outside the cities will tell us, like, don't say you from here. Don't nobody want to hear nobody from here. You know what I'm saying? So
then in 2010, he's just kind of hanging out at his house.
I'm in my apartment. Can I say I was smoking?
Yeah.
Can we do that on this I'm just high, just having a me day, just a self-care me day. And I'm watching YouTube, and what was hot in the streets at the time in hip-hop was 50 Cent, and the Game was going at each other. Game, it was like, man, I ain't G-Unit no more. I'm starting my own record label. It's Black Wall Street Records. And one of his homies was just screaming, Black Wall Street. It's Black Wall Street. We ain't fucking with G-Unit, blah, blah, blah. So while I'm watching these videos, I see on the related search section to the right, Tulsa Race Riot, Little Africa, documentary, 1921 Greenwood, all these documentaries. And I'm just like, Tulsa? So I click it.
At the turn of the 20th century, Tulsa, Oklahoma had the richest per capita wealth of any place on earth. It was dubbed the oil capital of the world, the magic city, and the city of dreams.
Black Wall Street was the wealthiest African-American community in the country in the early 1900s. They had planes, trains, pool halls, hotels, motels, jazz places, you name it. It became wealthy because during segregation, people had no choice but to spend their money in the community. And it was the kind of place where if you showed up and you needed help to build yourself a house and didn't have much money, people in the neighborhood would help you build that house that you could go on to raise generations of kids in.
Right before dawn, as many as 10,000 whites descended upon Black Tulsa. Opening fire. There was a block-by-block battle throughout the Black community. They would force the occupants of a house out. If people resisted, they were murdered on the spot. The homes were looted, and then they were set fire to.
The entire 35-square-block neighborhood, which is also known as Greenwood, was physically leveled to the ground in this deadly massacre, after a group of armed Black men tried to prevent one of their own from being lynched, essentially.
I was so mad, like, why has nobody told me this? I'm 22, 23 years old, and why I never got this information when I grew up on these streets that they talk about.
And that's unfortunately really common for Tulsans. Even the city's current mayor didn't know about this history until he was 23 either.
I hated that. I hate that we didn't know that. I think it would have helped a lot of us, like, mentally, if we knew. Like, even if you grow up in wealth, you walk different. Like, you talk different as a kid. Like, you carry yourself like you're getting ready to take on the family legacy. But us, we felt like we didn't have nothing.
Here in Tulsa, a tale of two cities. About half of the city's Black population lives in North Tulsa. South Tulsa is more than 70% white and has twice the median household income. Studies show that residents in wealthier South Tulsa are expected to live 11 years longer than those in North Tulsa.
Once I found out about the Black Wall Street situation, my lyrics got very home-based.
From Tulsa down to the city, we built a committee, you know. We killing beats by the plenty like we some young biggies. Treat your mind like a shovel. If you not deep, you don't dig me. Bubbling
like soap and water. It went from never talking about Tulsa and trying to sound like I was from L.A. or wherever, to being strictly like, y'all gonna get Tulsa when y'all hear me, because we got something that y'all need to know where we from.
Under the street lights, ride through the city. Ain't got no destination, but I got my dreams with me.
That's when everything started to make sense. I knew I wanted to be one of those homegrown, hometown hero artists. Like, where you from again?
New York.
So Jay-Z, Biggie, Fabulous, these are all people that represent where they're from very well. Yeah. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I wanted to be one of those artists also. So
yeah.
It's funny, he mentioned this trope, which is so true, the hometown hero in rap, right? There's certain people that's like, they represent that place. And on some level, there's no way to fake that, right? You can present, you know, here's this region to the rest of the world, but unless you're also connected to that desire of the people back home, it doesn't work. You have to have both ends of it.
Yeah, that you have to really have this community swelling and lifting you up, definitely.
But he's like, by now he's like, he's got albums out that he's selling locally. People know him locally at this point. There are people that are fans of his, or is he just like kind of in the wilderness?
At this point, he's still kind of in the wilderness, discovering his sound. He's hitting the streets with his homemade CDs. Getting in trouble for loitering, trying to sell CDs in corner stores, getting kicked out of corner stores. But that was ultimately really great for him because he bumped into other rappers who were also pushing their CDs. And they were able to carve out a little home for themselves at this dive bar called The Sound Pony, which used to be a white punk rock heavy metal place. When somebody's performing, they're kind of in the middle of this circle with all their friends jumping around them, mosh pitting. They really created this platform where they were the center of the world in that one little slice of the city.
Hands up!
Yeah.
Hands up!
So Steph applies for these major music festivals.
South by Southwest and A3C.
But he keeps getting rejected. Denied. No Steph here.
And I was like, I'm going to make my own festival. Like, I don't got to go to South by Southwest. I can do that right here where we at. We got a dope street, main street where we rapping at. I'm going to get all these venues, and I'm going to call it a festival, and I'm going to organize it, and I'm going to throw a show.
He's never thrown a festival before, and he decides it's going to be called World Culture Music Festival because he's thinking big. He's like, I'm going to take on South by Southwest, you know? Like, it's on.
I went to Sound Pony. I'm like, hey, can I book a show on this date? And they like, yeah, that's cool. So I went next door to the next door venue. And I was like, hey, can I book a show on this day? And they was like, yeah, that's cool. And I was like, well, can I use the patio stage and the stage inside? Like, they're like, yeah, like, you're trying to do like two shows? I'm like, yeah, like a show out here and a show in here.
So he basically cooks up a plan to get a bunch of musicians to come to this thing.
I didn't tell the venues that I booked shows all on the same day because I didn't want anyone to second guess it. And then April 1st, I dropped this big ass flyer and it said World Culture Music Festival. And it's like 40 names on it. It's like three venues. And so the day comes and I'm just sitting there. And by 10:30, you can't walk down there. It's just like,
oh, snap.
And I'm like, what have I done? Like, I'm like, what did I do? Oh my God. I'm so used to crowds getting like that. It's a fight or a shootout. And so I'm start getting paranoid because I'm like, I didn't do any insurance or nothing. Like, I just did this on some, like, you know what I'm saying? Please, I hope nothing happens. And it's just getting more people and more people. By 12 o'clock, I'm getting dizzy because, like, the rooms are spinning. After the night was over, the bars was like, hey, man, let's do this again next year, same day. And it turned into 5 days long.
Wow.
Yeah, it turned into a whole week.
Downtime with the pack. You put the time on the map. It's tired of hearing all the cap. They want to play to pull up at the mat.
I mean, that's like this kind of sneak music festival. And the fact it got so crazy that he was worried that something might happen shows that he had identified something, right? There was a hunger for something that he had tapped into.
Yeah, definitely. That this was a city that had no hip-hop scene to that extent before, and that he's able to show that Oklahoma is here.
Right.
Drop them off at Navy, this ain't what you want. You better hold step, don't beat me to the punch. How you gonna steal, then try to stunt? My city was burning, they was eating brunch. I'm plotting revenge, rolling up the runs.
But remember, Steph's ambition is to be a hometown hero rapper, and like you said, that's not just about getting his music, his friends' music heard in other places. It's also that you have to really be about the issues going on in the city. And because of Black Lives Matter, people start to pay more attention to the history of racism in the city. And then a particular fight starts to emerge in Tulsa.
The street is named after Tulsan Tate Brady, who was a prominent businessman.
In 2011, an article came out about a Tulsa City founder named Tate Brady, who is basically like the Rockefeller of Tulsa.
Big money guy.
This big businessman who built up the city. And the article exposes that he was basically a white supremacist. Surprise, surprise.
He was secretly a KKK member.
He was Oklahoma president of Sons of Confederate Veterans.
Tate Brady was a prominent businessman in the early 1900s.
And then in 1920, Brady builds a mansion house modeled after Robert E. Lee's right up against the thriving part of Black Tulsa that's basically outshining Brady's white downtown district at this point. Like, if you spend money on a mansion on a hill that is overlooking these Black people who are, like, flying planes in your face, and you're a KKK member, like, and you're also somebody who crafted this city, you're envisioning them not being there for long. Mm. The article kicks up this, like, big debate over whether to rename a prominent street named after him.
But there are concerns he has ties to the KKK and the Tulsa race riots of 1921, which is why many are in favor of a name change.
But his descendants are defending him in the local newspapers, and he becomes this fresh new symbol of the white supremacist Tulsan that has been allowed to stay around unchecked for a century.
The council vote was split down the middle, 4-4. One of those no votes.
So Steph decides to jump into the fray. He writes an album about Black Wall Street. And at the same time, HBO has a show in production that'll introduce many people, including me, to this history for the first time. Watchmen. And all of a sudden, this event that even many people in Tulsa didn't know about is suddenly on the minds of people all across the country.
That's Taylor Hosking. Our story about Steph Simon and the history of the Tulsa Massacre continues in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I feel like a mastermind. Other half tell me stay humble. Really, I be trying. Really, I'm just tired eating TV dinner. So I had to go and shift the paradigm. Really, I'm just had to break the cycle down. Rich blacks all around. Hey, hey. Rich blacks all around. Rich blacks.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and we're hearing the story of Fire in Little Africa. It's a concept album about the Tulsa Massacre of 1921. That attack was the coordinated assault and destruction of an entire neighborhood that was known as Black Wall Street. The death toll remains unknown even today, but the massacre stands out as perhaps the worst single incident of violence in the terrible history of Jim Crow. And it's being commemorated this year, the 100th anniversary, with documentaries, official events in Tulsa, and one very unusual rap album, which was organized or convened by a Tulsa rapper named Steph Simon. Taylor Hosking tells the story with The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham.
So Taylor, when we left off, you said Steph starts rapping about Black Wall Street, right?
So Steph creates an album called Born on Black Wall Street that can sort of serve as his personal story of what it means to grow up in the aftermath of this massacre. And he decides he wants to shoot the cover for this album in front of this evil guy, Tate Brady's old mansion house.
I knew it was Tate Brady's mansion. I knew the history behind it, but I wasn't like being super woke on the issue. I'm just like, yeah, I'm about to stand out front of this mansion. Like, yeah, I'm black and I'm proud.
This mansion is modeled after Robert E. Lee's home. It's a very Southern antebellum style house with like the big tall stone columns on the porch mm-hmm. and the big like sprawling balconies. So he just pulls up one day unannounced and he's like, I'm just going to get these shots off. Let's rap. You know,
is he dressed like you told me, like a sort of new age cowboy?
Yeah. He has the wide brimmed hat going on. He brings his little daughter. And this car on the road starts to slow down as he's taking shots.
Oh my God.
And somebody slams on the brakes mm-hmm. and rolls down the window. And then he just hears, Steph, what you doing, man? Like, what's up with you?
You scared the shit out of me. Excuse me. You just scared me really bad. Okay. It's his friend.
Yeah.
Ends okay. up I thought this was about to turn into a movie of Southern Gothic horror or something.
I know, right? Well, stay tuned. So it ends up being this guy, Felix Jones, who was in the NFL for a time and out of Tulsa for a while.
He retired, and I probably haven't seen him for a long time. He pull up. He like, man, what you doing? Like, and I'm like, man, I'm shooting the album cover, you know what I'm saying, in front of Brady Mansion.
So it turns out that Steph's long-lost friend Felix just happened to buy the Brady Mansion.
You want to go inside? And I'm like, hell yeah. Like, this you? Yeah, like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
that's like the best version of like, this you.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, no, this is my house now. Let me show you around. So the two of them start, you know, going all through the house.
We go in.
They see what used to be the maid's quarters.
And we showing us everything.
The balcony where Tate Brady would have been able to see the Black Wall Street community. The kitchen where he eventually ended up killing himself.
Kitchen. We go in the kitchen. I'm like, this is creepy. We go in the basement. I'm like, ew. We go upstairs where he kept his workers and stuff. Like, it's like,
This place sounds so haunted.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is a, sorry.
Yeah, and so
I would not spend a single night in this place.
I know, right? Steph's like, listen, man, let's turn this place into the heart of our hip-hop scene. And Felix is all for it.
He was like, man, I want to start a record label with you, man.
Like, let's put a stage in here, let's throw a show, mm-hmm. let's set up some recording studios.
And let's do it.
So you're right, they sage the whole house down, get some smudge sticks.
We're just trying to get all the spirits up out of this thing that we can and push positivity out of it this time.
And we ain't come to riot or march. We want results. We coming to take your pockets apart. Taking control of the art. Taking control of the plot. The benefit we gonna reap as long as you play your part. Be no lame.
This is happening in 2018, and then in 2019, that show that had been in the works at HBO comes out, Watchmen. Mm. It's set in Tulsa and paints Tulsa as a key place for a story about race in America.
Right.
The show is a huge hit, and suddenly all eyes are on Tulsa. So off kind of in the horizon is the fact that the 100th anniversary of the massacre is coming up this year in 2021. And there are rumors of Oprah coming to town, John Legend, LeBron James, Russell Westbrook, all these celebrities that are interested in telling Black Wall Street's story.
And I was like, man, if they're interested in here, somebody's going to shoot a movie on this. You know what I'm saying? And then I was like, hey, I want to hurry up and get my album ready so it can be the soundtrack when the movie does come out.
And the city's feeling the pressure to look good in the national spotlight, so they start throwing money toward their own commemoration events that can facilitate tourism and make it seem like they want to restore Black Wall Street's legacy. But the city's actually been giving away prime Black Wall Street land to white developers in recent years and overlooking Black entrepreneurs that want that land. Mm. Like, if ever there was a time that Steph could get the entire nation to pay attention to Tulsa and its rap scene, that is now. And that's when Steph's friend Stevie Johnson comes to him with an idea.
Yeah, you tell me.
Stevie's an interesting dude with a PhD working for this big money nonprofit, but he's also really embedded himself in the rap community. And of course, because this is Tulsa, Stevie's idea came to him in a dream.
It was so clear, like very vivid. And I just started getting on my laptop and started writing.
Stevie's like, look, let's call on every talented rapper we've ever met in this city, in cities across Oklahoma, bring everyone together to Tate Brady's mansion to record a mega album together. And it's gotta be everyone, not just Steph, because that's really what Black Wall Street was all about, coming up together.
It just goes back to like the blueprint we already had. We gotta move different, we gotta talk different, we have to think different. And let people know, like, community really is the true essence of, like, becoming free.
So Steph, Stevie, and their artist friends decide to go all in on this project, which is called Fire in Little Africa. And if it works, then the whole nation could hear about the Tulsa rap scene. I get an email inviting me to come out and hang out with Steph, Stevie, and their whole friend group while they're recording this album in Brady's former mansion house. So I pull up to the house and it's this beautiful spring day. I'm like, this is incredible. Everyone's kind of like gathering, laughing, smoking, hanging out. These truckloads of equipment are pulling up to the house. There's like six different recording studios set up all around the house. There was a chicken wing food truck outside, TNT Wang's, that has menu items named after rappers in their scene. There was this legal marijuana business tabling in the living room with like the most official career fair ready setup. And the artists who weren't performing were making documentaries about themselves that could easily end up on a big streamer one day. Just like this mentality of, if you build it, they will come, you know? I thought I was coming to cover a community that I'm not a part of. But as a Black person, the walls just kind of started falling down in a way. I was circling up with people to focus group our creative ideas. I was giving out my Instagram, all these things that you're not supposed to do when you're there as a journalist. It was this feeling of coming home to a place that I never knew was a home of mine. It felt like home because I was realizing a lot of the communities I'm a part of in New York, spaces where I get to be around folks with similar backgrounds, like queer Black creatives, those communities are mostly full of people focused on their own careers. They're people who want to be with their own, be celebrated by their own, but they're also not always willing to sacrifice their time, resources, or clout for others. I was seeing how you can think bigger and feel lighter when you're surrounded by people who don't just want to like your photos of winning, but actually want to help you win because they see your fates as intertwined.
the same way you feel when you get back home is the same way they're going to feel when they hear it. I want to go back to Tulsa. They're going to get the audio version. We're going to paint that picture for them.
I think hip-hop is going to respect it. I think hip-hop is going to see what we're doing, the flavor that we bring, and then be like, yeah, like, I fuck with Tulsa.
View. Like a fresh pair of penny loafers with the polish on it, tell them keep on shining. Like a diamond on your pinky when you sippin' Pinot Greasy, tell them keep on shining. Always knew you had to.
They recorded 140 songs that weekend. 20 or so will be on Fire in Little Africa, which comes out in 2 weeks. And drumroll, the album was recently picked up by Motown Records.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, Black Wall Street might not be a physical location anymore. It might not be as big and glamorous and mind-boggling as it once was, but it's in the person who sold 10 t-shirts at a market. It's in the person who left their pickup basketball game early to write their business plan for a new startup idea or write a pitch for a book about their life. We're not the same, and I put that on my search history. All of that's really incubating at this mansion that once overlooked Black Wall Street and was owned by a Klansman, and that Steph had the vision to turn into a real home for his community.
Picture this, Greenwood Ave, Redman's land. See the brilliance built by a black man's hand. It was for us, by us, false prop, plot us, hold up, try us, peg leg, got us, we radiate.
Fire in Little Africa, about the 1921 Tulsa attack, is out later this month. Taylor Hosking is a freelance writer and a podcast producer. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for this week. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses,
Annabelle Bacon,
and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.